Candlelight by Tuesday Love Sang Rampa, read for you by Blue Friend in beautiful BC. Chapter 3. The most honest man in Montreal stood square behind his shuttered door and peered through a crack at the scene outside. The street was like a battlefield. Police cars and motorcycles roared around. Bottles and rocks flew through the air, landing with a satisfying crunch. Across the road from the store, where High Mendelssohn stood on guard over Simmons' cameras, the great embattled promises of La Presse loomed as a symbol of might of the press. Yes, the striking pressman had brought the great roaring machines to a halt. No longer did the ticker tape spew out miles of messages. No longer did yammering reporters hound those who were deemed newsworthy. The press strike was a long time when, for some, the air was cleaner. May the strike long continue. But for people like High Mendelssohn, boss of Simmons cameras, the loss of business was great and serious. Behind his store, a new throughway road was being cut. In front of him, the La Presse strikers, police, barricades, all the impediments to honest trade. Now, of course, the strike is over and High Mendelssohn is prospering again. Why do we have to have strikes when so many people are out of work? If people aren't satisfied, then let them give up their jobs to those who will do the work. Why blackmail a whole country, a whole continent, just at the whim of a few money-hungry leaders of communist-inspired unions? The press and the unions, the curses of modern-day life. High Mendelssohn, a good man, an honest man. Why should he and others like him be almost ruined by fighting strikers? If it is not embattled pressmen stopping trade on the street, then it is striking mailmen preventing him from running his very efficient mail order business. I have known him for years. He's a good friend of mine, and I feel strongly that all these vicious strikes should so harm the innocent and the just. Montreal was like a beleaguered city, roaming strikers, very efficient police, and gangs of would-be revolutionaries lounging insolently on street corners. Long-haired men reveling in their dirt and deliberately torn rags swaggered along the streets, muttering outlandish and uncouth greetings to others of their ilk, whom they met briefly and passed on. Montreal, where French Canadians did not like French Canadians, where it was frequently very difficult, as I found, to get any attention in a French-Canadian store unless one spoke French. The city of two tongues, a city which I found it delightful to leave when the time came for that action, as you will read later on. The old man often watched from his home in the river, watched the flash of explosions by night, watched the flashing light of police cars in pursuit of arsonists, revolutionaries, watched the FLQ crisis, where a good and just man was murdered at the behest of some illiterate punk. Watched, too, when Mayor Drapeau came by, Mayor Drapeau, one of the finest, if not the finest, man French Canada has ever produced. Mayor Drapeau, who is so hounded by a press with no understanding nor conception of greatness. For it is truly a fact that Mayor Drapeau has made Montreal into a city instead of the collection of hovels it was before his advent. Yes, his worship is one of the truly great in this age of very, very little men. The old man, in the wheelchair, watched when the FLQ hoodlums went rushing by his window, escorted by grim police, when they were taking Diplomat Cross to the foreign territory of the Cuban pavilion on the site of Man and His World. The helicopter that took these gangsters off to the airport flew over the old man's head. But now, in the gathering dusk, the old man lay upon his bed, watching the lights of Montreal come on. The first dull glow of the newly switched-on street lamps, as they burned dull first, then quickened into yellow-green light. The multicolored neons on the advertising signs and the tall skyscrapers as they suddenly blazed into the light of nightlife. Way upon Mount Royal, the great metal cross stood limned in light against the darkened sky as somewhere a robot sensor responded to the stimulus of darkness and turned on a switch. Downriver, beneath the fairy tracery of the Jacques Cartier Bridge, a liner came steaming along, all aglow with strings of lights twinkling from peak to mastheads, to sternposts and jackstaff. Little tugs with sides beribboned with lights fussed around the ocean giant, while from them came shouts in the peculiar patois, which the French-Canadian believe is French. Gliding lights in the night sky and the muted roar of jets showed the arrival of aircraft from the capitals of the world. Sabina from the Belgian cities, Lufthansa, KLM, and the streaming crowds from Britain. There came, too, a plane from Russia, a rarity which now is a rarity no longer. The aircraft of the nations of the world flew overhead. Now, though, an increasing number flew non-stop to Toronto to avoid the inconvenience and rudeness of the airport of the City of Two Tongues. But the hours crept slowly by. Lights changed. Fresh ones were lit. Others were extinguished. Traffic on the road slowed but never stopped, for this city never slept. The old man turned, glanced without affection at the pile of letters yet to be answered, and mentally consigned them to a warmer place. Tomorrow, he thought, he would start early and clear up the lot before the next day's bunch arrived. So thinking, he turned over and went to sleep. Others in the house may say that he snores like a grunting pig with the overtones of a rusty gate, but when one is astral traveling, well, one is entitled to snore. Morning came, as morning will, in even the best regulated of households. Morning came, and with it came the time once again for work, the never-ending drudgery of letters, letters, letters. Here's a question, which is very topical, because acupuncture is very, very much in the news at present. The questioner writes, I have read so much about the wonders of acupuncture. No one seems to be able to explain exactly why it works. Could the 12 major areas of insertion of the needle correspond to 12 psychic centers of the body, thus explaining the mystery and perhaps providing a link between the third and fourth dimension of existence? Yes, there is so much mystery about acupuncture. Unfortunately, the press have over-dramatized things. Acupuncture is far more effective in the Far East than it is in the Western world. Now, the reason for that is not difficult to seek. I repeatedly state the truth that humans are just puppets of the over-self. All right, when was the last time you went to a puppet show? Have you ever had a puppet in your hands? Even the simplest of puppets have a string which controls the head. Other strings control the arms and legs, so even the simplest of puppets have 5 controlling strings. How many more strings, then, can a human, which is quite a complicated sort of puppet after all, have? Acupuncture works by intercepting a nerve stream, by shorting out a nerve stream which has some defect. For example, you might have a car and you find that you cannot use it because every time you switch on the ignition and associated circuits, the fuse blows and you cannot exactly find out what is wrong with the car. So, if you do not have all the time in the world to spare, you locate the area in which the trouble occurs. It might be, purely for example, the horn which has a defect. So if you cut out the horn for the time being, you can drive your car and go to a garage where the car can be repaired. The acupuncture process, temporarily, shorts out a defective part of the nervous system and causes the stimulation to go in a reverse direction, which causes very considerable alleviation of the condition giving distress. We have our puppet. The puppet's strings go to the hand of the operator, but the hand of the operator is controlled by the brain of the operator. So, if the puppet does not manage too well, it may be the hand of the operator cannot manage to carry out the commands of the brain. Now, let us replace that. Let us say that the puppet is a human. The hand is the brain of the human. And then we can see that if the brain cannot give the right messages to any limb or portion of the body, then a dysfunction occurs. And if it is in an ordinary puppet, then possibly a string could be lengthened or shortened to carry out a temporary repair. We do the same type of thing, in principle at least, with acupuncture. But now, why does it work better with the Easterner? Well, the Easterner has a different set of vibrations from the Westerner. The Easterner is more concerned about the things of the spirit, more concerned about the life after death, more concerned about moral values, ethics, and all that. So the Easterner is more able to accept the reality that sticking a needle or two into one's shuddering anatomy can cause a dramatic decrease in the physical symptoms. The Western world is more concerned about the things of this life, more concerned about getting power over others, more concerned about making money in a hurry and not parting with it, except for one's own creature comforts. The Western world is not able to believe anything unless they can get their hands on it and tear it to pieces. And when they've utterly destroyed it, they say, "Oh, well, fancy that. It did work, after all. Too bad it was destroyed in proving it was right." I believe even the Christian Bible has something to the effect that unless one be as a little child, one cannot enter into the kingdom of heaven. All right, unless one can have a childlike simplicity and a true faith that there are things which humans on earth cannot explain, then one will not be benefited by acupuncture. Acupuncture is not a faith-healing thing at all. There's no faith in it because acupuncture really does cure, but first, you have to have the metabolism of a sensitive person who can accept the reality that a cure is going to be effected. Now, that is different from faith healing. Some people say, "Well, you prove that to me and I still won't believe it." Like the old woman who went to the zoo and saw a giraffe and exclaimed, "Gee, there ain't no such animal." So, no matter how good the acupuncturist is, no matter how brilliant his needles, unless the person who is to be treated has the necessary spiritual apperception, a cure will not occur. And the press, hearing of such a case, will eagerly rush into print and thoroughly discourage and lower the perception point of others who could, without press intervention, have been cured. Now, here's a nice little question which also undoubtedly is in the minds of many people. The question is, does one ever have to return to, say, the fourth or third or even the second or first dimensions after having existed somewhere in the fifth through the ninth dimensions for reasons of having led a wantonly evil life in one of these higher planes? The answer to that is a very definite no. If a person is a naughty boy in the third dimension, he comes back to the third dimension. He doesn't go to the second. I believe you get the same sort of system in schools. If a student doesn't do his work very well while he's in grade 3, then at the end of the term, he goes on vacation and has an unpleasant interview with his parents, and at the end of vacation, he goes back to school in grade 3. He doesn't get moved down to grade 1. In the same way, a person struggling along through the school of evolution does not come back to a lower grade, but only to the same grade. So if you misbehave or do not learn your lessons properly, then you will be coming back to this poor, sorry old earth again, where conditions are going to be a bit worse for quite a long time. People come down to lower dimensions for special purposes. They are volunteers. Do you remember the old army story of volunteers? The sergeant says, "Hey you, I want 10 volunteers. You, you, and you." Well, perhaps people in much higher dimensions take a look at the earth and shudder at what they see. Then they go back and come to the conclusion that someone, some specialist, will have to return to the earth as a volunteer and find out what is wrong, and then help the people of the earth get back on the right path. There are a few snags attached to that, because one of the greatest laws is that you cannot use, for your own gain, knowledge which you have acquired in a different dimension. You have to live as a denizen of the third dimension, or whatever it is, and make do with the facilities inherent to the third dimension. Another usual reaction is that the volunteer is different, so that he or she is persecuted and all too frequently disliked, because the person is in effect a foreign body, a splinter in the body of the earth. You, for instance, if you get a splinter stuck in any part of your anatomy, well, you make quite a commotion until that splinter is dug out. The volunteers have also the painful experience of finding that they are not popular. It doesn't matter who they are. Even Christ was persecuted. Even Gautama was persecuted. Even Moses had more than he could deal with. And during their lifetimes, they were not popular. They were regarded as nosy parkers, as do-gooders, etc., etc. Only after such a volunteer has been gone from the earth plane for many years does it dawn on the earth people that, oh, well, the person must have been some good after all, and then they write a Bible or two about him. But that doesn't help the volunteer very much, does it? At the present stage, the poor, wretched volunteers have a further hazard to the success of their work. The pressmen are always looking out for anyone who is different. And if a person is different, he doesn't play ball with the press. And so he gets persecuted, and he's called a fake, and that further inhibits the success of what he is trying to do. He may, for instance, be doing very well indeed at his voluntary task, but then some crummy pressman cooks up an entirely imaginary story together with documentary proofs, and that really does cause a very considerable obstacle to a good task. There's another question which fits in well here. The question is, having achieved the ninth dimension, is one crystallized to become one forever with the Creator, irrevocably and forever and ever? Well, no. One is never crystallized. There's always something higher to reach for. Do you know the old statement, there's always room at the top of a ladder? I have often referred to the ninth dimension. Okay, let me give you a new target, the 900th dimension. Now, there is no point at all in trying to explain to you what the 900th dimension is, but there is a 900th dimension, and there are some higher. But if you cannot even understand the fourth or the fifth dimension, how can you even begin to understand the 900th? One rises and rises and rises. Of course, if one fights every inch of the way, it's slower to rise, but people always have their own opportunities. And I state definitely, definitely, that no one is ever destroyed. Not even the press people. Hey, you think I'm going on about the press people? I have reason to, you know? I've had a lot of trouble with the press people in England and in Germany, in France too, and as you will read later, in French Canada too. But no, I'm not bitter against the press. I'm not bitter against anyone. But It is stupid to sit down like Ferdinand the Bull and just smell the flowers while some ill-disposed people are trying to cut one's tail off for oxtail soup. Oh no, do not think that I am bitter, because I am not. Do not think that I am attacking the press unfairly. I am not. I'm telling the truth. They are the ones who cook up the tales. But back to our dimensions. Old Hitler or Stalin or a few others of that type, well, they will not be bumped back to the first dimension, you know. They won't even get bumped back to the second dimension. They will come back to the third. And let me whisper something. Is your ear ready for a nice juicy whisper? Well, here it is then. It is a fact that the real villain and tyrant of this life comes back to a new life as a ranting preacher. For instance, a man who has been a real sex pervert in one life may come ranting and preaching against sex in any shape or form, without having any regard as to how the race is to be continued. In the same way, a fellow who was the chief torturer of a very fierce country will come back as a very, very sympathetic doctor, maybe. Things have to be equalized, you see. It's a case of lose one, gain one. You have to balance things out. So, if you are a real thug in one life, you come back as an imitation saint in the next, because when you go to the Hall of Memories, you see what a mess you made of things. So, you return full of bitter remorse, thinking about what a scoundrel you were. And you go overboard, rather. You overdo things. You become extreme. And so you get a real hearty old sinner coming back as one of these galloping priests who roar around the world, teaching people to do nothing except squat on their haunches and bellow out a hymn or two. So, if you get any really good preacher in the next few years, well, it just might be old Hitler come back. Now, how did I get into a bunch of questions like this? What am I having to work out by having myself saddled with such queries? Look at this one. Is all creation composed of the vibrations of the musical octave, with most of these octaves higher, or perhaps even lower, than human ears can detect? Everything is vibration. Every single thing, even so-called dead matter, vibrates, otherwise it could not exist. You get a lump of rock, and you can't hear the noise it makes, but some creatures somewhere could, and they perhaps call the rock the singing stones or something, which would be a change from the rolling stones, wouldn't it? But all vibration is life. All life is vibration. And humans can perceive only the very minutest spectrum of vibrations. There are some places where rocks sing, and there are some places where rocks are, in fact, creatures. They may take 100 years or so to make any movement which would be perceptible to humans, but these creatures, having a few million years of life according to Earth's standards, are quite satisfied with their rate of movement. In any case, they all go at the same rate, so they don't know what slowpokes they are. This next question logically, I suppose, should have been placed two questions higher. The question is the Earth itself designed to evolve to a higher plane? Is the Moon on a plane below that of the Earth? And is this too destined to evolve to a higher plane and be replaced by another creation on the original level of the Moon's lower plane? Now my head is in a whirl with all of that. How many questions is that in a bunch? I'd better stop for a moment till my head stops whirling. Seriously, though, the Earth is like a classroom. You wouldn't say that a classroom evolved. You wouldn't say the classroom of the grade 3 student suddenly evolves and becomes a grade 4 classroom or a grade 5 classroom. A classroom is a classroom, and that's all there is to it. Of course, many different collections of students pass through the classroom, just as many different collections of civilizations pass through the Earth. And every so often, there are tremendous cataclysms upon the Earth, which plow up the surface of the planet so that all trace of life is lost and buried a few miles below the surface. That's why there's no trace of Mu or Lemuria or Atlantis. That is why there's no traces of civilizations eons before Atlantis itself. Think of the farmer. He goes along with some horrible-looking implement, and all the surface of the field is churned up, and it's turned over and plowed deep so that there's a new surface ready for the fresh seeding. And that is how Earth is. That is how the gardeners of the Earth go on. When a race gets too bad, along comes something to turn over the surface of the Earth and to bury all that which appertained to a previous decadent civilization. And then there's a fresh Earth upon which to plant fresh specimens. The Moon, or the moons as the case may be, are not in any way inferior to the so-called parent planet. The Moon, in fact, may just be a large asteroid which has been caught by the gravitational field of that world, which is about to become the predominant body, such as the Earth has the Moon as its satellite. And then you must also remember that people are used to life on Earth. They consider that all life must be that which is acceptable to them. It doesn't mean at all that life on the Moon, for example, must be identical to that upon the Earth. The people could, for instance, live inside the Moon. To reply to this question, then, one can only say, no, the Earth does not evolve to a higher plane. It's just a classroom for people who are evolving. A sudden commotion. The old man looked up from his work in some exasperation. Letters were bad enough to answer without unwelcome interruptions, but the visitor came in sight. "Hi," he said exuberantly, then sobered up a bit. "Say, you never read the French language papers, do you?" "No," said the old man, "I never read them at all, never even glance at them." "Well, you should, you know," said the visitor. "They've been running quite a lot about you lately. Dunno what's bothering them, I'm sure, but they seem to regard you as a personal enemy. What's the matter? Wouldn't you give them an interview or something?" "No," said the old man. "I do not propose to give interviews to the press, because on every single occasion when I have given an interview, My remarks have been grossly distorted in their reports, so it's better not to see any pressmen, and then we know that any interview is entirely imaginary. The visitor plucked at the lobe of his ear. Well, I don't know about that, because how are you going to tell people that you didn't give an interview after all? And even if you did tell them, knowing how people are nowadays, they probably wouldn't believe it. No, replied the old man. This is one of the cases when you can't be right, whatever you do. Tell you something, said the visitor. I used to think you were a bit paranoid about the press, but some of the things I've seen lately, some of the things I've read lately, lead me to believe that you're not such a nut after all. Seems everyone's had trouble with the press. Listen to this. He ruffled about in his pockets, turning out bales of paper, and sorting through the tattered mass, he came to a sheet which seemed to satisfy his search. So carefully he unfolded it, and he read, Now here's something for you. It says that Thomas Jefferson said some years ago, he said, Even the least informed of the people have learned that nothing in a newspaper is to be believed. Now, what do you think of that? Now, here's another one, a real gem. Winston Churchill once wrote, The essence of American journalism is vulgarity divested of truth. Their best papers write for a class of snooty housemaids and footmen, and even the nicest people have so much vitiated their taste as to appreciate this style. The old man smiled and said, Oh, I can do better than that, or if not better, just as well. You know, General William Sherman, a big American general, well, he once wrote, I would rather be governed by Jefferson Davis than to be abused by a set of dirty newspaper scribblers who have the impudence of Satan. They come into camp, poke about among the lazy shirks, pick up camp rumors and publish them as facts, and the avidity with which these rumors are swallowed by the public makes even some of our officers bow to them as spies, which in truth they are. But there's no point in going on such lines, so the old man said, Well, I've got work to do. You'll have to make tracks elsewhere for the time. I must get on with this, or people will think I'm a very bad author and that I can't reply to letters. So beat it, will you? With a sigh and a hunch of the shoulders, the old man turned back to his work again. Now, here's a question which should be of interest to many. It is. When I go to the Hall of Memories, if I decide I have learned what I've set out to learn on this earth, do I move on to a plane of existence on a spirit world, or do I take the human form again but live on a different planet in a different universe? Well, if, when you get to the Hall of Memories, you decide that you have accomplished that which you set out to do, then you will not return to the earth. There would be no point in so doing, because you will have passed. Think of school life again. Think, if you go to a university or to a school, then there's no point in returning to cover a course for which you already have a diploma. If you succeeded, and if you're satisfied that you've succeeded, then you can remain in the astral plane for an indefinite time, or you can go on to another form of world where possibly the carbon molecule is not the basic brick of life, But maybe there's a silicone molecule or some other type of material. And there you could learn by kindness instead of by hardship you endure on this earth. There is hardship on this earth because this is one of the hells. Cheer up, this hell will not endure forever. The same person asks, on the next plane of existence, is the routine similar to that of the earth, suffering, pain, and hardship until we have learned more lessons so that we may progress to the next plane of existence? Actually, I have answered this quite a number of times, but let's go back to it again. Basically, no. As you evolve higher and higher, you have less and less to endure. Take as an example, conditions on this earth, where the laborer gets the hard work, the bruises, the bad language, etc., whereas the president or general manager of the company seems to make the most profit, or at least that was so before the labor movement got underway and sort of reversed things, to the detriment of the world. But anyway, the point is that the higher you go, the more rapidly you will progress, and the easier are the conditions. Mind you, I'm actually referring to the basic physical things. No one will disagree that the laborer digging holes in the ground has quite a lot of physical hard work. He gets messy conditions. He gets the rough side of the tongue from his foreman if he doesn't do his work properly. So he gets hard physical work, but the president of a company or the general manager may sit in comfort in a padded chair, but he does have a lot of non-physical work to do. His is the responsibility for seeing that the less evolved, which might be the laborers, are doing their work. So I do want to make it absolutely clear that the higher one goes, the greater are one's moral responsibilities. Look at it this way. The lowest laborers can go out and get drunk and have a fight. No one thinks anything about it. But if you got the higher people, a duke or a prince, if they went out on a pub crawl and got involved in a fight, well, that just wouldn't do. And anyway, it wouldn't happen because as they progress upwards, they get increased moral responsibility, increased moral and ethical discipline. They get greater respect in themselves and in their abilities. But the physical work is for the lower people, so that when you are on this earth, if you are in the lower stages, you have the hard work. When you progress upwards to other dimensions, you do not have such hard and unpleasant conditions. But of course, you have greater responsibilities for which your hard work will have trained you. Well, this person seems to be getting his money's worth. He's got a whole list of questions, but they are questions which seem to puzzle a lot of people. So here's the next question. What is the end going to be of all these planets that people live on, all these planes of existence, when the time comes that everybody has been through all the planes of existence and gained all the knowledge from these numerous lives? What do we do then? You cannot discuss this at present because of the limitations of the human three-dimensional comprehension. If you go into the astral world consciously, you will know precisely what happens, and in terms of Earth, or even human comprehension, there is no end to it. It's like leftover meals. You start off with a good meal one day. The next day you get the thing heated up. The next day after that they make it into risoles or something. And eventually it returns to the earth, makes fresh plants which feed fresh humans. And so it goes on. It's an endless cycle of existence. You've told us in your books, the questioner continues, that there are many universes. Does our universe overlap with any other? Or are there just voids of darkness in between? There are billions and trillions of universes. Now, how can I make that clear to you? Well, let us imagine that you are on a seashore. At your feet, there are all the grains of sand, and these are in touch with each other, but you would not say that they overlapped, would you? Some are so small that they're just dust, and some are great rocks or even mountains, and in fact there are mountains beneath the sea, just as there is sand beneath the sea. Think of all the grains of sand and all the rocks upon the earth. But all the grains of sand upon the earth and all the rocks and stones do not in any way equal the number of universes there are in the whole general system. And beyond this system, there are others, on and on and on, ad infinitum, until we reach numbers far beyond human comprehension. Still with the same gentleman. I have to answer this gentleman because up to the present I've done so many questions for the ladies that I do really welcome a gentleman with some sensible questions. But anyway, he goes on. In one of your books, you describe how you went astral traveling with your guide, the Lama Mingyar Dondup, and someone called Jigme to a red planet. When you were there, you talked to some other people who told you it was a dying planet. Were those other people in the astral form or in the human form, or did you materialize in front of them? You mustn't become confused between what is astral travel and what is physical travel. I didn't take a Greyhound bus to the red planet, that's for sure. But when one goes astral traveling, one can still be completely visible to a clairvoyant or completely audible to a telepath. So the red planet to which I went was populated, although extremely sparsely, and the population consisted of a very highly evolved people who were clairvoyant and telepathic, just as on this earth people hear things and they see things. So they could actually see us just as if we were solid lumps of flesh and bones. They could talk to us, and we could talk to them. We could see everything on their planet, and they could see us. Actually, it was astral travel, conscious astral travel under full control, but that made no difference at all to them, and it made no difference at all to us. We were there. Now, here is something for you to think about. You read this a few more times and scratch your head and think about it some more. You may be out in the street and you may see in front of you a person walking about in a perfectly ordinary and natural manner. But Are you sure he really is there? Are you sure he's not an astral traveler who is stimulating your sensory perceptions to an extent that you believe he's a solid figure, whereas actually he may be in the astral vibrating on a frequency which is compatible to you, and so you are sure that you actually see him with your physical eyes. You can't go up and take a poke at a perfect stranger and say, "Hey, you, are you there or something else I see?" But if you could, and if your finger poking went right through him, you'd probably drop from the shock, wouldn't you? Another little thought, oh, a nice little thought, this. You know all that talk about people who come out of flying saucers, or to be more respectful, UFOs? Have you ever thought that if these people who came out of such things were so frightfully alien that we couldn't believe them, then we wouldn't see them, would we? Think that over. If a thing is too different from what humans can believe, they won't believe it, and not believing it, they won't see it. Yet another simple little thought. These people may be of a different vibration, a vibration which is at the band of invisibility so far as humans are concerned. They can see humans, but humans can't see them. You think that sounds crazy? All right, but how about this? Dogs can hear sounds which humans cannot. So are you going to say that the sounds which dogs can hear and humans cannot, those sounds are not there? The dog can hear the sounds and also hear the sounds which humans hear. The dog can hear both. So why should we not have people from another world on such a different range of vibrations that humans cannot perceive them? You think about that, and then see if you don't feel somebody looking over your shoulder. He has two other questions here, which have already been answered in a previous book of mine. He asks, did man evolve from the sea into apes, into man? And where do the different races come from? Out of space? The gardeners of the universe? That's easy. All you have to do to get those answers is read The Hermit. The hows and whys and wherefores are given clearly in that book. End of chapter 3.